The Economic Alliance presents the Gulf Coast Grow Show, recording from the Shell Studio, with your hosts, Jason Lee and Clint Aiken. Our mission is to highlight stakeholders and activities that drive the Houston Port Region's economy.
All right, and welcome to the Gulf Coast Grow Show. And I'm here today with Senator Larry Taylor, and I'm my co-host, Clint Aiken, and we are ready to kick off season three, and I think it's perfect. It couldn't have been better timed that on November 1st, which is better known as Movember, we are here talking to the man who his staff says is promoting back in the stash. So I think that's a perfect way to kick off our season. We didn't really time that, but it worked out fantastic.
Worked out great,
so Senator Taylor, we're glad to have you.
Well, thanks. I'm glad I could bring this.
And we're glad to bring you with it. So I think that's perfect. So exciting times. And so, Clint, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about our guest today, and then we'll jump into the conversation.
Yeah, so Senator Larry Taylor represents District 11. So, and basically, you've been doing this pretty good while. You started off in the Texas Congress. Texas House, and now you're into the Texas Senate. So, tell us a little bit more about that background.
Well, I started in the Texas House in 2003, spent 10 years there, and I've been in the Senate since 2013. So, I'm in, just finished up my third session.
Okay.
Check that fourth session.
And one of the things y'all are really starting to hammer into is going to be the HB3 bill, right? So can you tell our audience a little bit about what that is and what that looks like?
Well, House Bill 3 was a comprehensive education, school finance, and education reform bill.
Okay.
Very large bill, full of all kind of reforms, as well as changes to how we fund schools and how we dole the money out.
Fantastic. So I think to kind of highlight today's show, what we're going to do is we're going to hit a few of the key talking points that you've got on your agenda today. I think a lot of people don't really know maybe what a senator does, right? So I think we could kind of start off that.
I'm still
right?
figuring out myself.
Yeah, you're still figuring out, right? Yeah. Well, I know this. You figured out the mustache, and that's the first step. So, but back to maybe you could enlighten us a little bit about kind of the day in the life of what it is that you're facing and the work that's going on behind the scenes, and then we'll dive into a couple of your topics.
Well, as a state senator, you know, people confuse us a lot of times with what's going on in D.C. In the Texas legislature, we meet every other year.
Okay.
So we're in odd years from January, generally the end of May, unless there's a special session. And so we finished up our session this May, and since then we have what we call the interim. And during the interim, we have interim committees that meet and do all kind of things preparing for the next session. And of course, as a representative of my district, I have to go back home and tell people what we did last session and hopefully give them some reason to elect me to go back and do some more of that.
Fantastic.
And so we spend the interim doing, you know, many lunches, dinners, events, touring different types of facilities, whether it be schools, plants, all the things going on within the district.
Mm-hmm.
As well as keeping up with these interim committees that meet. In my case, I just was appointed to a mass violence prevention select committee.
Okay.
So we've had meetings in Odessa. We've had a meeting in El Paso. We've had two meetings in Austin on that issue so far. We're going to have some more meetings. So it's just a continuous stream of
nonstop
activities.
Fantastic. And I would imagine you get paid handsomely for
that. Oh, huge. You know, so many people want to get in this for the money. We have a gross check of $600 per month.
Okay.
And, you know, my hourly rate is, I hate to calculate it. Actually, it's a negative rate because my health insurance exceeds my salary. So I actually pay $180 a month to do this. So it's really a great lucrative position. I'm so glad I found it for my
Well, hopefully if we have time in the back half of the episode, we'll get a chance to kind of hear about what makes you tick and got you into into this position, because it's
serving us.
Sounds like it's serving, right? It's a tremendous amount of service, and you got to have a heart for something like that. But let's dive in a little bit about before we dive in, just to highlight us real quick, your district you're covering what areas?
I have part of Brazoria County, the northern part, and Surfside right on the beach. I have almost all of Galveston County except for Bolivar Peninsula.
Okay.
And then I have the southeastern part of Harris County. So I have the battleground, but not the battleship. I go all the way out to LaPorte, Morgan's Point, all those communities along the bay. I have part of Pasadena, Clear Lake.
Wow.
And had the Harris County parts of Pearland. And so it's a pretty big district. I'm fortunate compared to a lot of senators. You know, we have to divvy up 28 million people among 31 senators. So some of those guys that represent West Texas, their districts are huge, like the whole panhandle.
Right.
are the, you know, they have huge swaths of land because there's not enough people.
Right, right.
You know, to get up to your 900,000 people out there, you got to cover a lot of territory. So I'm at least fortunate that I'm within three counties.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think one thing I heard from that is we're talking about a really diverse population, and
so.
both from a socioeconomic perspective all the way down to probably the amount of transient people who've moved into our area and just trying to represent
such a broad district
would mean that you have to have a broad thought process. You can't be, you know, one-track minded because you're trying to speak to so many different people.
Generally in the House, you're dealing with a very much more cohesive and homogenous type of district.
Right.
In the Senate, you tend to get more diversity and more different types of towns, size-wise, and
right.
all that. So it does give you a bigger view.
Fantastic.
Than what you had as a House member.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about some of the views, right, that you've kind of you've had, you know, established into some of the things that you've been working on, right? Because your view matters, and then it's stepping it into making decisions and things that we're now coming out of the just this past season. Now you've got a lot of things that you're trying to go communicate. You're trying to share some of the work that you've done. So let's jump into HB3, House
okay.
Bill 3. Tell us a little bit about some of the work that you guys have been doing.
Well, House Bill 3, once again, came out of the interim.
Okay.
Before this last session, the Supreme Court ruled our system was constitutional, but barely.
Okay.
And it was messed up. But they made a huge step this time. Unlike most Supreme Courts in the past, they didn't come up with a prescriptive thing, here, you need to do this to fix it. They said, it's not our job to fix it. The education finance system is the legislature's job.
Gotcha.
Which is accurate. That's what it should be. So we formed a school finance commission. And it was a diverse group of people. There were appointments by the governor, lieutenant governor, and the speaker. And they did an incredible job of appointing a very diverse group. People, different occupations involved in schools, in the business community, teachers, people who ran the accounting for schools.
Mm-hmm.
But then you had legislators from all over the political spectrum. And it was just a very diverse group. But that group met from January of 2018 through December of 2018.
Wow.
Over 100 hours of expert testimony, trying to figure out where we are, what's going on, what's working out there, where do we need help, what do we need, and look at our finance system, which is a very complex finance.
Right.
There's like a handful of people in the whole state who fully comprehended the whole thing.
Right.
Come up with best
practices.
Because
we had all these band-aids in previous Supreme Court decisions, so I mean, it just became this just a mess. And you'd pull one string here and three or four things would happen over there. And so anyway, that group met. Over a full year, that group came up with 40-plus recommendations unanimously.
Wow.
After all that time spent. And that basically became the foundation of House Bill 3.
And that's pretty rare, right?
Oh, it's extremely rare.
Any other topic, any other category, getting that many people to unanimously agree on how to move forward.
Try to get a school board to agree.
Exactly.
Much less when you're dealing with 5.4 million.
Me and Jason
students.
Can't even agree what we're going to eat for lunch.
Never.
Just two of them.
My wife and I can't agree on anything. Yeah. I don't even. So that's impressive.
This was a huge thing. And the bottom line is, as complex as HB 3 was, I mean, it had tax policy, it had education reforms, it had spending reforms, it had new programs in it. That bill passed unanimously.
Wow.
From the House and the Senate at the end of the session.
Wow.
Now, that's never happened.
I think before the show we talked a little bit about some of the benefits to it, because I know as a taxpayer I pay a lot of attention to what's happening in my area. I'm trying to understand it because I get a bill every year, my house goes up, I'm trying to sort things
significant
out.
Significant bill.
Huge. It's a good bill. Good bill is the wrong term. It's a nice bill. It's not a fun bill to pay. But I know it's worth it, right? And I get, you know, it's taking care of things. And I'm humble and grateful to go be in a school district that I'm proud of. I think they're doing some great work. But I know and it's not across your entire district, that's not the same, right? There's some opportunity for growth. But tell us a little bit about some of the downfall, some of the impact that the bill's going to have.
Well, not a downfall.
Or not a downfall. Positive.
Well, first of all, we identified areas where we really need to do better.
Right.
And we recognize that our demographics have changed in Texas. Now our largest demographic in Texas is kids who qualify for free or reduced lunch.
Wow.
60% of our students.
That's amazing.
That's also our fastest growing demographic. And historically, that's been our least educated.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you can't continue on that path and Texas continue to be the leader that it is today.
Right.
So that was one of our main focus of this whole school finance, beyond how we pay for it and all that, is we've got to do a better job then. That starts with early childhood education, starts with keeping and getting good teachers in the profession, because I mean that's the biggest significant, most significant factor you could have, other than family, is having good teachers in the classroom.
Right.
And so we've increased teacher pay. We put in incentive programs. We put in grant programs for districts to recognize their best teachers, pay them more money, and then if they'll agree to go to a more challenging campus, pay them even more money.
Right.
So we're talking about from increasing pay beyond our flat across the board that we did, which is about an average of about $4,000 per teacher.
Mm-hmm.
We've got grant programs out there that will increase teacher pays an additional $3,000 to $32,000.
Amen. Wow. That's
fantastic. So we have teachers in Dallas, ISD, under this program, who are getting $90,000 a year in the classroom.
Wow.
They didn't move into administrative, but these are really good teachers
right.
who are working in significantly under or significantly challenged campuses.
Right.
So, you know, 80-90% low-income kids. And they've done this in Dallas and have had incredible results. For example, one school, Blanton Elementary, went from 40% passing, and they had been failing for four out of the last 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
They were at a 40% pass rate. Within 1 year of implementing this program, they went to 80% passing.
Well, it's a significantly wow. underserved demographic,
yeah.
the teachers themselves, and rewarding them is huge. I think if I look at the amount of hours just from the emails and things that I receive inside of my network that's happening just to teach my daughter, coming from the teachers, they're teaching for 8 or 9 hours a day, and who gosh knows how much work has happened beyond that.
It's a challenging career.
Amazing.
Our commissioner does a pretty good job describing. We talk about brain surgeons. They're working on one brain at a time, and that brain is generally under anesthesia.
Right.
A teacher's working with like 20 brains, and they're all moving around like crazy and trying to help work with those kids. It's
unbelievable.
A challenging job.
Unbelievable.
But there are ways to do it. They're working really well. I mean, I tour different schools, and there's some great new ways of teaching these kids in our 21st century. Take advantage of the gifts that they bring to the classroom and
right.
take advantage of that. These kids are growing up with electronics and all that. It's not the same as what we had when I was going to school.
Right.
Their attention span's a little different, so you got to change your teaching style. So you can do that and get a great performance out of these kids.
Right. I think that's some exciting stuff, and I think it's very interesting to hear the amount of work and even observations and visits and things that you're having to take on and to go experience this so you can add value in those committees, right, so that you can speak to them intelligently. I think a lot of that goes by the wayside. They think guys just show up and do a meeting, start talking about it, and come up with something and send it out to the taxpayer. They don't realize all the man hours that go into being educated and trying to make the right decisions and represent our districts.
This was a huge job,
right?
But it was a labor of love.
Absolutely.
And I really have a passion for these kids, and I have a passion for our state. And I want our state to continue to be the great leader that it is. I mean, we're known worldwide.
Right.
I mean, people recognize Texas.
Oh, yeah.
But you've got to keep working at that. You can't just sit back and, okay, we're always going to be that way. You've got to look at the challenges before you, and this is what Texans do.
Right.
Whether you were born here,
I love
you moved here. We're Texans. We're a can-do state, and
yep.
people know us for that.
Right. Yeah.
And so what we had to do, we had this challenge with these large percentage of our kids being low income. We're going to turn that dynamic around. We're going to give those kids a good education. Those kids are going to get good, high-paying jobs, and their kids won't be on a free or reduced lunch program. That's how you turn this dynamic and change it back, and Texas will continue to lead.
It's fantastic.
We took on that challenge, and I think we've done an incredible job. The whole state came together to do this because they all saw the need. And I think you'll see the benefits of this. And I pray that what we've done will be blessed and that we'll go on and continue to be a great state.
One of the things we were talking about, too, before we started recording this was we were talking about the way schools were graded
mm-hmm.
on their performance before. Can you kind of touch on that?
Yeah, this wasn't part of House Bill 3, but a couple sessions ago, we went to an A through F.
Right.
Which is pretty easy to understand.
Yeah.
Parents get A through F.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of school districts didn't like A through F. But you have to understand the old system, we had improvement required and met standard.
Right.
Which sounds okay, you know, as long as my schools meet standard, until you find out the improvement required was just the 7th percentile and below. So if you were in the 8th percentile, you met standard, all the way up to 99th percentile. So mm-hmm. if you're in that big, huge range, everybody met standard.
Right.
What standard? We know that about 40% of our students require remedial education at community colleges and universities.
Yeah.
What standard was that? So the A through F really highlights, and it's very easy identifiable, and it's not just based on test scores, and it's not based on the students you have. Because we know that these kids who are there on free and reduced lunch have a much higher hurdle to get over.
Right.
But we're not measuring campus just on necessarily attainment, but it's growth. So if you as a school, you don't get to pick the kids who come to your campus.
Right.
It's a neighborhood school, that's who your kids are.
Right.
But you are required, or you should be required, to educate those kids. Mm-hmm. So from wherever they are, you need to be growing those kids. So we allow that in our system.
Well, let me give y'all some metrics that y'all could go back and give HB3 some teeth with, right? So that was, I just
Well, here's
really
the beauty
like
of it. A through F now, we can identify who our high flyers are.
Right.
Because we have districts with very challenging demographics, but we had some districts with high challenging demographic percentages that were getting A's. And then we had the ones that would say, well, you know, our kids are poor and they can't get, you know, they just come from rough. It's expectations.
Yeah.
But now we can identify districts with the same demographics.
Right.
Some are getting A's and some are getting D's and F's. The ones who are getting D's and F's need to look at the A's and go, hey, what are you guys doing?
Yeah.
Here's some best practice. Here's what we do. Here's what we found with Dallas ISD. They're doing this ACE program, Accelerated Campus Excellence. They're identifying their best teachers. They're paying them more money. And they're getting significant differences. They went from 40 plus campuses that were failing within a couple years to four.
Wow.
Now look at HISD. They've been going how long?
Yeah.
Wheatley, 7 years. We can do better. And that's what A through F is going to help us identify where we can do better. And parents, you know, once again, parents optimistically think their kids are getting a great education.
Right.
Blanton Elementary and Dallas ISD, the one I just talked about, when they were getting 40% pass rate, their parent approval rating of that district, well, that campus was about 80%.
Oh wow!
When they were at 80% passing, it was about 84%.
Wow! Awesome.
So the parents don't really have that connection unless you have a clear A through F, and they go, okay, we got a B. What do we got to do to get an A?
Right.
Or we got a C. What do we got to do to get a B?
Yeah.
And that's a process, continuous improvement, which benefits who?
Right.
All the kids.
So it's
everybody in Texas.
You know, that HB3 is building on the A through F.
Right.
And building on some of the things we've already done before, like closing campuses sooner. We used to have this system where you could be a failing campus for 7 years before you might even start to talk.
McCarthy Building Companies. From the Museum of Fine Arts to terminals on the Houston Ship Channel, we understand the challenges and complexities you face when building here in the Gulf Coast region. As the oldest privately held national construction company, we have a clear focus on clients, community, and collaboration. Just to give you some context, our Houston-based business does 15 to 20 projects per year. We are employee-owned with over 2,000 employees throughout the U.S. and 250 in the Houston area. For more information on McCarthy Building Companies, please visit www.mccarthy.com.
Well, I think if you look around, too, at our region, and you see all the work that's coming, and all the industry, and the jobs, and the things that are needed, we currently have a shortfall of people. We have tons of people, but qualified people to step into jobs. And that's only going to continue to happen because it's always been in our region. And as long as we have a port, as long as we have the traffic that we have coming in and out of this area, people are going to want to be here. But we need people, that next generation, getting educated so they can slide into some of the great work and opportunities that happen in our facilities like San Jack and the things that they're doing to help create jobs for the petrochem.
And they're doing a great job.
It's huge.
And that's the goal.
If we can funnel them there, we're going to see a lot of just more fuel for growth, which I think is exciting. Yeah. So sticking to the schools and thinking more along the lines of what are we doing behind the scenes to help our schools, talk to us a little bit about security and some of the things that you're doing to solve for that.
Well, you know, we had the issue of the school shooting.
Right.
Santa Fe is in my district. Very difficult issue to deal with. That was during the last interim as well. So that was something I was really keyed in on. You know, the school finance was an ongoing project we were working on, but I also needed to make sure we did something for our schools. So we provided additional money to harden facilities to try to make sure they were more secure as far as access, cameras, vestibule areas, we had secured access, those types of things. And then, you know, funding for additional resource officers, marshal programs, to make sure we had more people who could respond if something happened. But the most important thing we can do is not respond or that. The best thing is to go after the heart and the minds of the kids who are adults who are doing these things.
Right.
And that starts a lot with mental health and counseling and those types of things. And recognizing kids may be getting a little off the path, whether there's something going on at home or whatever reason. having teachers that are trained to look for those kinds of signs, mm-hmm. and then get them in with a counselor earlier and try to get them back on the path. Because what happens, these kids kind of get off the path. If they're never addressed, they kind of get on, they just start spiraling off on their own,
right.
as individuals. If you can catch them early on, you get them back on the path and keep them as constructive and productive right. citizens, yeah. not somebody who would do something as heinous as what we've seen.
Right.
So a lot of this school safety bill, Senate Bill 11, has to do with counseling. And we've got a statewide consortium set up with our higher education institutions to help form this. We have telehealth, where when they identify me in these rural areas, they can have access to counseling by phone and video conferencing. So trying to find ways we can get to the real heart of it. And that's with the emotionally disturbed, with the mental health issues, and catch those early on and save these kids.
Now, there's a lot of talking points and things that people are blaming for the problem. And I'm really glad that y'all are focusing on the mental health aspect of it, because when you look at the majority of what's happening, it's usually driven by mental health issues. Mm-hmm. So that's awesome. I love hearing that.
I think something that really struck me before we turned the cameras on was the funerals you attended and having to step into that. And I think a lot of times people don't really understand that behind the scenes, behind the job that you're doing, we're talking about a human being with a heart. And you said you had a passion for the kids. But I think it's an inspiration to people to know that you have to step into the front lines of some really difficult things that could wear on you. But I think that's great, because I think it really then pours back into the work that you're doing, right? And the sacrifice that are made to try to solve some of these issues. That just touched me earlier. I think it's important for people to know what you have to...
Well, when you're talking about like that school shooting, it's not aligned when you go to kids' funerals. We're supposed to go to grandparents and great-grandparents and people that are older than you. Any time a child dies is traumatic. Mm-hmm. And those funerals are some of the hardest ones to go to. But when you go to numerous mm-hmm. children's funerals back to back to back over like 3 days, that's probably one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do.
Yeah.
And I don't want to have that repeated. So I wanted, that was a passion to make sure. I love these kids. I love the future they have, but we also got to, we have to keep them safe. It doesn't matter how well you educate them, you can't keep them safe.
Right.
And so that was a very important thing that we did this last session, to try to prevent that from happening, doing everything we reasonably can. And a lot of that's just identifying these folks earlier on and try to get them back on the path.
Well, I wanted to make sure we captured that before we jump to our next topic, because it's important. It's important to people to understand that our representatives that are out there are people that get in there and deal with the situations and then go in and try to form solutions, right? As opposed to sitting in a big, you tune on the TV and you see everybody standing around, what do these guys know? Well, they know some things that potentially none of us, I didn't go to any of those, and so I think it's really important for people to understand the person that you are behind that. So that's great. Let's jump in and talk. We're going to shift gears now. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the things happening across the coastal spine.
Okay.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the coastal spine has been a long, ongoing project since Hurricane Ike, 2008. Mm-hmm. Dr. Merrill down at ADM came up with this idea of the coastal spine. We call it a coastal barrier. And I've actually toured in Holland some of the issues that they've had there and how they've dealt with it. Some of those same things we'll be implementing here was what we're working on. This started off about an $8 to $10 billion project, primarily to protect the bay and the ship channel from a storm surge. If you understand waves, Galveston Bay is a very shallow body of water.
Right.
We're talking about an 8, 10, 12 foot storm surge coming right up the mouth of that ship channel, 40 foot plus channel. That's a lot of water. Mm. Coming up into a shallow body of water, it jacks up. Hurricane Ike, first of all, was a near miss.
Mm-hmm.
If you understand hurricanes, they have the messy side where the wind's blowing that way. The eye actually went right up the ship channel. So all that bollard that you saw that looked like a bomb had gone off, mm-hmm. that was the messy side. If that storm had gone about 20 miles further west, that messy stuff would have gone right up the ship channel, pushing that storm surge up. And as it was, it went over bollard. Then we had Harvey, 50 inches rain, and you saw that flooding that did all over this area.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, 50 inches rain, 12 foot, 10 foot storm surge, that's a lot more than 50 inches.
Right.
And you hit a shallow body of water. So, and all of Harvey in our area, now of course Beaumont and Corpus weren't, but all of the Harvey flooding you saw in there, all those creeks, all those bios, where they drain into?
Yeah.
Galveston Bay.
Right.
So So it's important that we keep that water out of Galveston Bay. So the point is, you close the gates over the ship channel when the storm is coming, and so you knock out the storm surge, you keep that offshore, and then once it's gone in, then you can open the gates and all the rainfall can drain out.
Wow.
So it's a fairly, it's obviously complex but visually it's fairly simple. We already have a seawall in Galveston. It was built after the 1900 storm, by the way.
Right, right.
They built that thing up, and guess what? It's still doing its job today, over 100 years later.
Unbelievable.
And so what they're doing is talking about a spine tying on the seawall, going down the west end that way, with some kind of a dune system, or maybe a T-wall, inverted T with a sand over, looks like a natural dune, all the way down to Bolivar.
Right.
And so then we've added on Freeport, all their levee system tying into that, have a gate across the channel that can open and close. It's a multiple faceted thing, but basically just a gate. So most time it's open, ship traffic is going, but when the storm's coming, you close it.
Fantastic.
And then you go down Bolivar, do the same thing with the dune system, and now we're tying into Beaumont. This petrochemical complex we have here is incredible, not just for this region, but for this country.
Yeah.
It's actually a national security issue. We do like a half our nation's military aviation fuel here.
Right.
And don't quote me on the percentage, but it's a significant, it's higher than 50.
Right.
But anyway, so this is a national project. This isn't a bridge to nowhere in Alaska. This is something that means something to the people of our country.
That's huge.
So we're trying to get to, we've been working on the planning, the engineering, and so this last session, we got what I call the bookends. The federal government actually funded to do the improvements on Freeport and Beaumont.
Nice.
But we had to have a local sponsor and matching funds.
Wow.
This session, we're able to get the money to do that part, to make sure we kept that project going. Because if we didn't take care of that, this whole project was done.
Right.
Because the Army Corps of Engineers has hundreds of projects on their list. They get funded, I mean, hundreds of billions worth of projects.
I can't imagine.
And they get $2 or $3 billion a year. So if you're not ready when your turn comes up to bat,
right,
you're done.
Yeah. Right.
So we had to take care of that. So we've gotten the bookends. They're well on the way. We're still working. I just met with the Army Corps last week, this week, or earlier down in Galveston. They're putting together the final plan. We should have that by the... Now it's 2021, and hopefully we can get in line. What we need is a direct appropriation from Congress, like they did in New Orleans after Katrina.
Right.
They built all their stuff in 4 years. If we get all this design out there and go through the normal Army Corps process, they'll be working on this thing for 40 years.
That's unbelievable.
But if we get a direct appropriation, which they need to do.
Right.
I mean, if you're a business person, which our president is,
right,
and you point out that we spent $30, $40, $50 billion last storm, how many more storms are we going to have?
Right.
And this thing costs $10, $12, $15 billion one time, like the seawall, and it's still there doing its job today. That's a pretty good investment to protect all this petrochemical complex, 6 million plus people. This is a very worthwhile investment. We're not talking about pie in the sky, so I think we can get this done.
I think that's exciting, and I think that really, because we continue to see it happen, and then the dollars that flow that it damages us. I mean, that thing shuts down for one day; it's hundreds of
and
billions of
dollars.
It's
not a matter if we have another. We are going to have another.
It's coming.
We're going to have multiples in the next 80 years. Who knows? It could have been Hurricane Ike. Hurricane Ike could have been that $100 billion event that wipes out our petrochemical complex. Let me bring up Galveston again. 1900 storm. Before that, Galveston was the city in Texas.
Right.
It was the major city. It was it. It was the Wall Street of the South. After the 1900 storm, what happened? The Allen Brothers built the ship channel. Houston became that. And Galveston, a nice city today, but it's not the main city in Texas.
Right. Right.
And today's global economy and how mobile things are, if we get our petrochemical complex wiped out, how many of those are going to stay?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And hang around for maybe the next one.
Right.
Unless we do some proactive show, we're working on this, we're going to get this done and protected, I'm not sure I would rebuild there.
Well, a major upside is we're creating jobs and we're helping to keep jobs here. Because by building that, we're protecting the economy. But those storm surges, they won't cause the amount of damage they caused in the past. So people that are working on those plants every day, they'll be able to stay and work.
Well, if I'm a U.S. taxpayer, during Harvey, they closed the channel for about 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
Gas prices went up 80 cents on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
What if it had 6 months?
Right. We have no
idea.
It's
been 8 months, but maybe a year. So right. As a taxpayer, this is a good use of taxpayer dollars.
Right, and before we transition to, I think this is a great time to transition to the man behind the senator, right, and learn a little bit about you, and I'm going to let Clint take that, but you said something a little bit about surfing or something like that before that. Let me ask you a question. Now that you're behind the scenes on all the work and all the water that's flowing through, how many of your surfer buddies are constantly bugging you about where to catch the best waves?
Well, I my time surfing has been very limited.
I bet.
To get my schedule fit. You know, because here on the Gulf Coast, we don't have waves all the time.
Right, right.
And we have them there at a particular time, particularly now this, with the fronts coming in and out. So you have to be there when it happens.
But if we get a gate.
Yeah,
right.
That won't help on that.
Okay.
It's not like a wave pool.
Okay, all right. I think that's exciting, though, and I know that we need it. So thank you for sharing that. So this is a great time where we transition the show a little bit just to learn a little bit more about you. I mean, obviously, you've done a lot to put yourself in this position, a lot of sacrifice, and there's something that makes you tick. So I'll turn it over to Clint and let him just drive a few questions specifically about who you are, and then we'll wrap up the show.
Yeah, I mean, so obviously you're doing a lot of good things for the state. You clearly have professed your love for Texas and for the people of Texas, which I appreciate because I'm one of them. And but what motivates you to do that? What is your driving force that kind of gets you up in the day and says, "Hey, I want to make things better for Texans today"?
Well, I guess it started pretty early on in my young adult life. I mean, I was just kind of an active person involved in my community, just kind of a community service, not really ever looking to run for anything. But I grew up in the town that I live in today, and I was involved in a business in that town. So I was a member of the Chamber of Commerce and doing all those activities. I helped run the 4th of July Steering Committee. I just, at the end of the day, I never was really motivated by money. Mm-hmm. It was really more like taking care of my community. I'm in the insurance business. I even consider that helping the community because I'd help the small business guy get started and those kind of things. And so that's what I did. And I got to tell you, I first ran for state rep when I was 38 years old. Mm-hmm. The last office I'd run for was junior high parliamentarian. So there's a little bit of a gap in there. and part of the reason was when I was doing that junior high parliamentarian, I had to get up on the stage and make that speech to all my fellow students. And I won, but I swore I would never do that again. I mean, I didn't like that at all. Mm-hmm. And as it turned out, getting involved with things, I joined the Chamber of Commerce, ended up being elected president later, and I joined the Rotary, ended up becoming president. And it wasn't like I was trying to build a resume because I was working for myself. I was self-employed. But just,
right.
That's just what happened. But being president of the Chamber, I had to run a meeting once a month in front of people.
Right.
And then when I became president of Rotary, I had to run a meeting once a week in front of people. So I got used to having to be up in front of people talking and that kind of thing. And so all those things were preparing me for what was to come that I didn't know was coming. And that was, I don't know how much time we had, but my kids were studying Texas history.
Yeah.
And so we were going to take a field trip. So we load up. We had tents. We camped out at Palmetto State Park, my three kids. We go to the Alamo the next morning. Mm-hmm. We walk in. I got three kids, my older one. And you get in there in the chapel, and if you've ever done it, you know, here's where the families hid out during the siege. I'm going, wow. I've been in the Alamo a lot as a kid, but never as the parent.
Right.
So I'm doing all this kind of as a parent. Wow, there's like multiple families inside there, the whole siege. And then, of course, you watch the movie, and, you know, Travis sends out his letter, come to our aid. We're surrounded by, you know, 1,000 enemy troops. And these 30-some-odd guys from Gonzales got the letter, and they showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, gosh, you know, I just spent the night in that rocky ground. So kind of like where they came from, and they believed so strongly what they believed, and they were willing to sacrifice themselves. They had to sneak past several thousand to join 150.
Wow.
Right.
So your odds aren't good.
Right.
But these guys really believed in what they were doing. And I'm thinking, gosh, they weren't just putting their own life at risk. They were probably putting their family at risk.
Mm-hmm.
Because back then, you know, that was a pretty tough times.
Yeah.
But these guys joined it, and so I just kind of, in that same trip, we went up to Austin. They'd recently mm-hmm. renovated the Capitol, so we didn't even do the tour. We just kind of walked in and looked around, and went like, wow, I could just see my, I had no vision of that. That week, I go home, and I got invited to go to lunch by a state rep at the time, and another guy was a political guy, who had worked on other people's campaigns. I'd help, because I mean, I was in. I was always a student of history. I loved
sure.
what was going on.
Right.
Always happy to help other people. That wasn't my thing. And they said, we want you to run for state rep. I'm going, wow, my usual answer, because I've been asked to run for mayor, not mayor, but city council, school board, all this. And I just say, you know, I got a young family, small business, I'm happy to help you guys, but
right.
I'm really not doing it. I'd turn that down numerous times, but they asked me after that trip to the Alamo, I'm going, you know, they're not asking me to join 150 guys getting ready to give up their lives. They're asking me to give up, in this case, 140 days every other year.
Wow.
And I'm going, you know, if I believe in what I believe in, I really need to be able to do that. And they point out several, I'm also kind of a fixer. When I see something that's not right, I want to fix it.
Sure.
And they point out several things that were going on they hadn't been able to get done. I said, yeah, so I signed up. And I ran. And we had an incredible campaign, raised a lot of money from people I never knew, had no idea. Things happened in that campaign confirmed I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing. But we lost 58% to 42%. Wow, what was that all about? So anyway, they asked me to run for city council again. I said, yeah, I think I'm supposed to be doing something in this realm. Got on city council, spent 3 years there. The guy sat next to me, took the other side of every issue. And I just, it was exhausting, but I learned how to debate. I learned how to present my case and do all that, and had to explain tough votes.
Oh, yeah.
So redistricting rolled around, and my wife were talking about it. So you think we should run? Well, you know, it had to be a couple conditions. I'm not running against another incumbent, and it's got to be a friendly district because I'm not going to, I mean, I'm not going to go beat my head. And we spent a year campaigning, knocking over 10,000 doors, that whole bit. So it's hard.
Oh, wow.
So anyway, some guys had run before they moved out of the district. One guy had a job change, and the guy who became Speaker of the House after that election called me and said, we've tailor-made a district for you, because I'd met him during my first run. So I ran again in 2003. Mm-hmm. 2002 for the three session, and we won 58-42.
There you go.
But I can tell you, I was a much more prepared state rep the second time than I would have been the first time. But I met people that first time and convinced me what I was supposed to be doing. And I had that 3-year training on city council preparing. I was a much better state rep.
It's always interesting what God will be working on us during those.
But I still say I got sucker written on my forehead. That 140 days every other year, not so much.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but it's worth it.
Right.
I tell you, it's a privilege for me to get to do what I do. And it truly is an honor. And I look back on the things we've gotten done for Texas since I've been there, and it's all been worth it.
Fantastic. Well, as we get ready to wrap up the show, we want to just thank you again
Absolutely.
For the work that you do. I think you shared a lot of great information today. Is there anything else that you want to wrap up and close with?
I just appreciate the opportunity. I appreciate us all working together for our region. Mm-hmm. We are very blessed to live where we live.
I absolutely agree.
We're in the greatest state in the greatest country, and we are very blessed to be Texas. We just got to do our part to make sure it continues on that path.
I sat down with a guy yesterday, and you just hit it. You said, getting to do what we do and for the region, and I was explaining to him about the show because he asked about it, and I said, for lack of a better term, we are in my belief, one of the more dynamic regions that exists out there. And the entire economy in the United States, and yet I don't think people identify or understand the magnitude of work that goes into getting the things that are out in front of them every single day, the stuff that comes out and in and out of this region, and they got to get out and support it. They got to understand it, and I think being an advocate for that and spreading the word and sharing, the gospel of the Gulf Coast is important, and so we're trying to spread that, and hopefully, and we thank you for being a part of that. So
Absolutely.
We want to thank our audience for tuning in. You can always check in, subscribe to our page. Thanks to our guests. And we want to thank Clint for joining us today. And we're looking forward to seeing you guys on our next episode. Tune in to Facebook, LinkedIn, and you can always subscribe and send us your questions in our next episode. Thanks. Have a good day.
Thanks.
Cool. That was great.
Jamendo.com.